Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Doug Bierend, author of the new book, In Search of Mycotopia, Citizen Science, Fungi Fanatics, and the Untapped Potential of Mushrooms.
Doug is a journalist based in Hudson Valley, New York, who has written on subjects including science and technology, media, food, and sustainability for publications including Outside, The Atlantic, Vice, and Wired.
Doug approaches thinking about mushrooms as a metaphor, a lens through which to view community and the planet at large. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Doug. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, in your new book, In Search of Mycotopia, you explore the origins, communities, and movements surrounding fungi. And I was wondering, how did you become interested in mushrooms in the first place?
I think I followed a similar path to a lot of people these days, which started with discovering Paul Stamets and a particular TED Talk that he gave called Six Ways Mushrooms Can Save the World, or Might Save the World. There are a few versions of this title, which suggest it's certain or a maybe. And it introduced me to just this amazing variety of possibilities that fungi represent for healing landscapes, food sovereignty and security, medicine, all sorts of what they call applied mycology principles that at the time were really exciting to me because I was writing about technology and media and I was looking for hope basically in stories about new inventions and systems that might help us resolve, you know, social, environmental problems. But I was getting disillusioned with the tech discourse and all the hype and the fact that whatever innovations came from that space would have to be plugged into the same system that created the problems in the first place. And mushrooms kind of came out of an oblique angle and just presented this whole new space of possibility, and also introduced me to land and ecosystems and much broader consciousness that in the 6 or 7 years since that moment have really changed my life. But when it really started to kind of take over was actually when I started reporting on this kind of radical mycology movement, which is a term that's loosely used. It's a specific thing, but it captures, I think, the spirit of this community. And I was first introduced to it when I visited a person named Olga Sogas upstate in Rochester.
From Smugtown Mushrooms.
That's right. She's the proprietor of a small mushroom cultivation operation up there that operates out of this nondescript warehouse. And I mean, it was just an interesting story to me, this kind of anti-capitalist mushroom business.
Yeah, you call it the mycelium underground, which I think is amazing. And specifically this like nature first anti-establishment movement or attitude, I guess we can say. Can you tell us about that? I mean, it must have been sort of eye-opening to any underground movement that you enter. It becomes really eye-opening because it becomes massive and sprawling. Tell us a little bit about when that started and what you first began to think.
Sure. Well, yeah, it was on that visit, and it was to see all of these people. It was a pretty punk kind of vision that I stepped into of, you know, literal like denim jackets and pins, you know, Motorhead pins, and it had the aesthetic of a punk scene and also some of the attitudes, but you know, instead of bands, they had shows there and stuff too, of course, but it was mushrooms, you know, just being surrounded by mushrooms. And yeah, it was just such a strange environment and mix of aesthetics and concepts and attitudes that it was super alluring to me. And then we ended up going on a forest foray, they call it, where you're looking for mushrooms. And that was a sort of spiritual experience that turned me on to the world of mushrooms in nature, which is, I think, the experience shared by this subculture. These people often, it's hard to speak of them as a single group or as a monolith. I think there are like trends and attitudes that are consistent, but it's apolitical, or maybe super apolitical. It's not defined by any one set of adjectives, really. But there are some common things. These are folks who obviously fell in love with fungi. And through that, I think, similar to what I was just saying, kind of found a holistic perspective on nature. Mm-hmm. And that perspective extended into how they view society and our role in it. And so a lot of these people are growing mushrooms for medicine and food and trying to operate at a local scale and support their communities and respect their landscapes and contribute to systems of production and consumption and economics that are, you know, reciprocal and sustainable and just by definition, you know, subversive to the status quo, which is none of those things. So yeah, it's obviously like mushrooms are at the center of a lot of the conversations in these spaces, but the conversations really seem to be about broader themes. And I find that really alluring.
While still being apolitical.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I use a term like anarcho-mycologist early on in the book, just to kind of give us some color to this. You know, I think there's an anti-capitalist attitude, even though a lot of them are engaged in business, you know, and they're entrepreneurs. And so there's some tension there, but it's never explicitly political. I think there are probably some anarchist ideas at play or, you know, some libertarian ideas at play, but the conversations never seem to focus on, you know, this or that political ideology. It's always about like problems of inequity, of white supremacy, of all these social ills that you might not expect to be talking about if you go to a fungus festival.
Mm-hmm. And that was, I guess, the start of the journey, but you went on to uncover all sorts of communities. What were some of your most striking findings about mushrooms and the communities surrounding them that you uncovered writing your book on this journey?
I think it pertains to what we were just talking about, which, I mean, there's all sorts of fascinating details about fungi that, you know, you can discuss how, you know, they're a huge part of our body mass. You know, they're a part of our physical being in ways that we're only beginning to understand. And the same goes for basically every plant on earth. They connect everything and people spend their whole lives just diving down that rabbit hole. But to me, the most fascinating thing is just how they bring people together or how they are bringing people together. And I don't know if that's something to do intrinsically with fungi or if it's more the context of our moment where people are looking for alternatives to systems that are showing their failings. And fungi are this maligned, often overlooked, marginal kingdom of beings that we're just starting to sort of figure out how to form a modern relationship to. And I feel like there's maybe an opportunity in that to sort of set the terms early on for how we're going to engage with this massive dimension of the natural world that also is so important to our life and all life. And it seems like maybe people are trying to set the terms in the way that we were just talking about with these attitudes and with a kind of subversive bent. And I found that just utterly fascinating. Like, why mushrooms? You know, why are they doing this? And I guess that's sort of what I set out to explore in the book.
And are these communities connected, or were you connected to the other sub-communities through that initial one? Or how did you go about finding the people?
I think the communities at the point that I started writing this book were more connected than they had ever been. There was a distinct kind of East Coast, West Coast divide, but there's been mycological societies throughout the country for 60 years. And so there's an infrastructure for people to learn about mushrooms, to build community around them. But this is a distinctly younger, more diverse, and also has different attitudes and priorities than the mycological society tradition typically does. So it seemed to have emerged kind of in parallel or separate from that. And thanks to the internet, obviously, and a recent popularity of fungi, they're big on Instagram and Facebook, the trends just kind of collided in a way so that right at the time I started reporting this, you know, people were literally driving from New York to California to attend events that, you know, like the POC Fungi Gathering in San Diego or New Moon Mycology Summit in upstate New York. Like, I saw the same people at both. So they're definitely connected, but I think that's a relatively new dynamic.
And as you were moving through this reporting and meeting more people, how was your sort of worldview shifting? Was your perspective on things shifting, obviously outside of mushrooms, just your perspective on life?
Yeah, this reporting definitely followed a track along with my own sort of transformation, personal transformation, and spending a lot of time in the woods, spending time among people who put the biosphere above their profit and who find ways to raise issues that to me are maybe the most pressing of our time in a context where, again, you wouldn't expect to find that. And obviously just to discover this incredible aspect of nature and this world of life that drew my attention to the living world in a more focused and considered way than I had ever done before. Even though I'd spent plenty of time outdoors, I would consider myself an outdoorsy type. You know, I wasn't the sort to stop and stick my nose into a log and find joy there that came about by this experience. Mm.
One thing you go into in your book, which I find incredibly interesting, is how mushrooms can remediate contaminated landscapes and waterways. Could you talk a little bit about how exactly they can do this, and should we be growing mushrooms at Superfund sites?
Well, first of all, how they do it is, I mean, there's all sorts of mechanisms, but the basic process is that they exude enzymes as part of their process of digestion. Mm-hmm. Fungi grow within their food instead of consuming it like from the outside, like animals do, and they don't produce their own energy like plants do through photosynthesis. So to eat, they sweat out basically enzymes that are chemically complex. A lot of novel chemicals have been discovered just through fungal, they call it exudates. Mm. And a lot of those chemicals have the effect of binding up heavy metals or dissolving certain compounds that can be found in polyaromatic hydrocarbons or even weapons materials like explosives, RDX, nerve agents, things like that, all sorts of stuff. And it's a field called applied mycology or mycoremediation that is gaining a lot of popularity because it sounds super promising. Like you stick some mushrooms in the ground next to a chromium spill and it'll soak up the chromium. That's really exciting. But it's not that simple, of course. You know, there's always more nuance to it. But the basic process is just that, like introducing fungi into an environment that's compromised or contaminated in some way and finding the strains or the species that exude the right chemical to do the job you're looking to do there. And it's a field that's been around for a while, but that has kind of sat on the shelf because people found a few mushrooms that they thought did the job they needed. And there's a whole universe of mushrooms yet to be discovered. And so now people are trying to advance that cause. And that comes down to just studying biodiversity, basically, which is a huge blind spot for fungi.
Why is that? Why is it such a blind spot?
Well, I had it described to me by Bryn Dentinger, who's a professor at the Natural History Museum of Utah and the university out there in Salt Lake City. He's a mycologist, and he was saying that mycology is essentially at its Victorian Revolution phase, where tools have emerged, the equivalent, I guess, back in the Victorian age might be the microscope, that have made it possible for widespread study of fungi. In the case of fungi, a lot of that's down to genetic sequencing that can discover fungi, which are often invisible. A lot of them don't produce mushrooms, and they live as these invisible threads woven into leaves, or they only live in a pile of dung, and you wouldn't know it was there unless you did this genetic test that pulls out DNA from fungi if you're looking for that. And so a lot of it's down to the tools that exist, and a lot of it's down to just a culture within science and more broadly that has often marginalized fungi. They were considered basically a weird, you know, cousin of plants up until 1969, I think, is when they were formally given a taxonomical rank as kingdom, which is a pretty significant upgrade. Yeah, I think it's just a legacy of being misunderstood, of being hard to study, and just not prioritized because they weren't, frankly, profitable like plants and animals were to the institutions that were traveling the world looking for them.
Mm. In terms of sustainable farming and food systems, and particularly in the climate crisis and the situation globally we find ourselves in, what sort of role do you think mycology can play?
I think mycology is uniquely positioned to help guide the conversation about how to address climate change, in part because there are these applied mycology notions and techniques that can, in more sort of nature-centered ways, address contamination or food scarcity. They can work with waste products. Like a lot of mushrooms are grown off of grains from like breweries or straw from farms that, you know, gets put to much more productive use this way and actually gets turned into soil and compost afterwards. So it presents a lot of ways. That's one example of creating virtuous cycles, closed loops. There's a kind of permaculture perspective on mycology and fungi that the two are growing deeply intertwined. but also at the level, I think, of shaping the conversation and how we, I mean, if nothing else, just giving us some humility in the project of addressing our role on this planet, because fungi represent a huge mystery to us still, even though we've learned a lot about them. They're proof of how little we know about the operating of the planet, and our, and a clue that that we should probably operate a little more respectfully and sustainably. And I think that's sort of broad and maybe even Pollyanna-ish, but I also feel like it's a, it's missing from the conversation a lot of times about how are we going to deal with the environment.
Connected to this, and you sort of mentioned it briefly earlier, is social justice. And I'm wondering, you know, from the perspective of food justice, social justice, what role do you see mushroom cultivation playing?
I mean, I hate to keep repeating myself, but it's, but it kind of comes back to this thing about just how it gathers people together. And I mean, that's where I see the potential. Honestly, part of the intention of the book was to cut against this impulse that I certainly had and that I see a lot, which is to say, like, here's the solution here and let's just scale this thing up. Whereas what I came away from this experience feeling is that whatever solution we're looking for is a lot more down to these fuzzy notions of how we behave and how we relate. So along those lines, people are meeting to discuss fungi, but in the process, they're saying, you know, hey, fungi are being elevated as a therapeutic, psychedelic mushrooms in particular, and they're starting to be legalized, and now there are like retreat centers opening up, and there's a lot of excitement about the potential for this way of dealing with depression, end of life anxiety, and all sorts of stuff like that. But it's probably going to be distributed along the same lines that every other privilege or resource is distributed. And so, for example, the POC fungi community in San Diego, or unceded Kumeyaay territory, as they would say, was a gathering of people of color, indigenous people, Chicanx, I guess is the term to use for some of them as well. And they met to build power, basically, and to build community around fungi. And one of the themes that they were really centered on was medicine and how, I think this is a line in the book, like, if they're opening up a treatment center near me, I don't know if I can afford the $500 to benefit from this medicine that I actually have a cultural connection to. Meanwhile, it's scheduled as a narcotic alongside crack cocaine or heroin, you know, it's highly illegal. And so the social justice aspect, I think, is inherent in, I mean, any resource that we're talking about or any, you know, anything that's going to involve distributing something or you know, working at a societal level, and you're talking about social justice. To me, again, the power of the fungi here is in creating a space where these people who feel marginalized and excluded from the discourse about fungi in the kind of broader, more mainstream sense, still have the means and wherewithal to gather and put on an event that was, to me, just deeply inspiring. It was beautiful, and everyone there was so happy to be there. And again, it was like ultimately not about the mushrooms at all. You know, I think there's something in the way that mushrooms behave in nature and all of the applications that, that people are finding for them. And, you know, those applications have different meanings in different contexts. They were talking about micro-remediation at the POC fungi community gathering as well, but they were talking about it from the perspective of a community that faces a higher rate of contamination in their landscapes as a result of environmental racism. And, you know, instantly you've gone from mushrooms to environmental racism as a conversation. So, long way of saying that I think mushrooms can help inspire the kinds of conversations that might help us remediate at a social level. And even some of the people who were trying to engage in micro remediation have since moved over to, you know, what I term in the books like social remediation. They, I think, have taken that message and applied it at a different level. And to me, that's kind of what I'm trying to get at with the book, is like, mushrooms are cool, but maybe they can bring us into contact with other ideas that are broader. And,
yeah. Mushroom is metaphor.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. And I mean, we've spoken around it a little bit, but obviously psychedelic mushrooms and psilocybin as medicine has been a huge topic over the last couple of years. What specifically have you learned about where that's at, what we understand about it? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's obviously growing in a fast way. There's a lot of, you know, legalization measures in various pipelines around the country, and states or cities are adopting them. I can tell you that the psychedelic movement is fundamental to the movement that I'm documenting in this book, if only on like a technical level, but certainly on a lot of other levels as well. But in the 60s, 70s, you know, there were a lot of efforts among people who had only recently discovered, and I use that term cautiously, discovered is really not the right word to use, who extracted, maybe I should say, magic mushrooms from Oaxaca, Mexico in the 50s and started to experiment with them, found that it was becoming difficult to go to Mexico every time you wanted to, you know, have a trip, and started developing techniques for cultivating them at home. And those techniques gave birth to networks on the internet of people sharing tips to refine, like a kind of Reddit for psychedelia. One of them is called mycotopia.net or shroomery.org. These are decades old now, forums that are still vibrant and active. A lot of those specific cultivation methods, but also that kind of collaborative approach, directly inspires the cultivation that's happening now of medicinal mushrooms and culinary mushrooms. And obviously, there's some talk of psychedelia in those circles, in these like radical mycology circles, but it's really kind of secondary to what they're talking about. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's quite central.
Right.
The only other thing I'd add is that, bouncing off the social justice aspect, a lot of talk about the distribution of these medicines and treatments and stuff. And so I think that's more what people are focused on in this space, is how to make whatever gains are coming for psychedelic mushrooms and their therapeutic potential, that it be pursued equitably.
And there are these spiritual cosmic elements beyond the psychedelic aspect of mushrooms that are discussed as well. Specifically, like ethnomycology, you talk about, and how they play a role in mythology and folklore and the sort of history of it and the connections across humanity with mushrooms.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, ethnomycology is, there's incredible scholarship that's been done, but a lot of it is down to guesswork and supposition as to like how these things, how they were discovered or incorporated into culture, or really if they were used in the way that people think. So Gordon Wasson is the famous initial ethnomycological figure. He's the one who went to Mexico and undertook the Velada ritual with Maria Sabina and quote unquote discovered the magic mushrooms, brought them back to the U.S. He went on to write a book called Soma, in which he made an argument that the Amanita muscaria, which is like this white and red speckled Super Mario mushroom, was actually Soma, a mystical elixir referenced in the Rig Veda. And no one knows what it was. All they have are some descriptions of the process that was involved in producing Soma. And Wasson was convinced that it was the Amanita muscaria, and that, you know, one of the filtering steps was the bladder of a deer, and some interesting, you know, stuff to think about. It could be true. I think it's based on his supposition, and that's just one example. You know, obviously in South America, there's, and in Central America, a lot of tradition around psilocybe mushrooms, and a lot of interesting history about like colonizing, you know, Catholics discovering these people, you know, going into trances and acting like demons. And they started putting a requirement that you disclose the consumption of these mushrooms if you're going to take communion. And there's not really a single story to tell about fungi and human history. I think it might be reflected in the different kind of attitudes we have toward them today. Like here in the US and in the UK, there's what is commonly called mycophobia, just a sort of automatic aversion to mushrooms. And similarly, it's hard to pin down exactly where that comes from. It seems to be just a cultural inheritance, maybe, you know, the result of blights or some other events in history that just sort of cast them in a negative light. I think it's got something to do with our attitudes toward rot and decay as well, which we view as bad things.
Yeah.
But if you go to Eastern Europe, if you're hanging out with someone out there, it's pretty likely within a week or so, you'll be looking for mushrooms in the woods because it's just part of the culture. Mm. And I'm not aware of any like psychedelic traditions in Croatia or wherever, or Romania. There may well be, but there's definitely a more clement kind of view toward fungi there that seems rooted in deep history in ways that I don't know we'll ever really unpack, but those connections are there. And the more we discover about it, I think the richer that picture becomes.
I wanted to cover two quick things that are sort of adjacent to what you've been looking at, which is the microbiome, which we've talked about a lot on this program, which is also an emerging sort of field of understanding. And do you think, in similar to mushrooms, that the microbiome can sort of communicate as a body independently of our conscious involvement, like in the way that mushrooms are independently a single body, do you believe that the microbiome is communicating with other microbiomes?
You mean like between bodies?
Yeah.
Interesting. I wouldn't doubt that for a second. I mean, I'm no scientist and I'm
not just like from your travels.
Yeah. But that said, I've been convinced by the sort of spooky action at a distance that can occur in biological, you know, interactions and that there are levels of connection. You know, you think about like pheromones and whatnot emitted by trees and the kind of communication that you might see, or just looking at like mycorrhizal connections underground and at the root level. I feel like we're connected in so many more ways than we'll probably ever understand, but certainly vastly more than we appreciate now. And I think there's probably a lot of signals being sent through our, you know, various emissions that, you know, we might not notice, but our bodies do.
Right. And there's also this idea of the connection within mushrooms about how like a forest can be imagined as a kind of a single superorganism rather than a grouping of independent individual ones. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how mushrooms are one of the connectors of the forest?
Yeah, you can kind of think of them as like a missing piece, I guess. But even that to me feels like a fallacy because it suggests a border, you know, between that piece and the rest of the pieces. And what fungi did for me, and I think I've heard enough people say this that I could say it does it for a lot of people, is it connects everything that you have noticed about the forest before in your conception of it, but that's because it does it literally. You know, fungi are facilitators and they're moving nutrients around and they're cutting deals between organisms for sugars and other minerals and things. And so it's like an underground energy economy, just in the mycorrhizal example. You know, even as a layman, spending enough time swimming in that perspective and in the woods kind of learning about these things, it really shifts your perspective of the forest as a collection of discrete things, like a bunch of trees or of soil as like dirt. You know, I think we often mistake soil for dirt when it's a living matrix that is, the term emergence comes up a lot, where you end up with these complex phenomena and behaviors that are more simple than the constituent parts, or at least what you see as the constituent parts. It's the relations that kind of form I mean, you could say it of our brains too, you know, it's literally just a mass of connections, but it creates something that we can only really describe as magic, you know, at this point, or is probably rankling some nerves with that phrase. But we don't understand human consciousness. We don't understand plant consciousness or nature consciousness. I mean, we don't understand consciousness at all. I think there are probably various species of it and scales of it. You know, that's my own view, but I think I can hold that view without giving up my, you know, my acceptance of the material nature of our being. And yeah, I got all that by walking in the woods and thinking about mushrooms. So,
well, we haven't really touched on the pandemic, and I was curious, how have you engaged or been engaging with mushrooms through this pandemic? And when it comes to cooking, what have been some of your favorite mushroom recipes?
Well, it's been winter here in the Hudson Valley, and so the mushrooms have not been as profligate as last, you know, few months or in the previous few months. But in the fall, I was really, really enjoying chicken of the woods mushrooms, which if anyone listening has not tried, it tastes just like it sounds. It's incredible. And yeah, I'm really blessed to be in a situation where I can step outside and not worry about the virus so much because I'm in the woods and I'm not so concerned about catching it from a tree or giving it to one. But, you know, I can go out and commune with the forest and with fungi here. And so that's, I think, kept me sane throughout all this, frankly, as has cooking. And I mean, the book was reported right on the borderline of the shutdowns and the kind of shift to this world we live in now. So I hope it's not just like a time capsule, you know, but that it still like resonates as relevant. The world it documents is up to like February 2020. And, you know, I caught up with some people who I had interviewed in the book after COVID, you know, had been around for a few months. And the example of like the POC fungi community, for them, the pandemic offered a test case for this community that they had started trying to build. And, you know, I talked to Mario Ceballos, who's the founder of that group and that event. And he was saying that, you know, they had taken the connections that had formed at that event, which was just before shutdowns happened, and had carried through those connections into COVID in ways that had really helped the community feel supported by itself, you know, and they had markets and they were selling their medicines. And it comes down to, I think, that aspect of the, you know, the medicine picture, which is like this or that chemical or molecule or whatever that's going to have an effect on this or that receptor versus medicine that came from community, was produced with intention and integrity and is supporting your community and not an industry. And there are health benefits to that too, and maybe a more emergent sense. So that's what I've heard. There's some of what I've heard from people as far as like how COVID has affected their relationship to mushrooms. And
well, and I imagine the notion of local growing has really become something more prevalent.
Yeah.
As we emerge from this particular moment, what is giving you the most hope for when we get out of COVID, and what I guess about the mushroom world and realm that you've been swimming in gives you the most hope?
You know, it might sound a little flippant or counterintuitive, but what comes to mind is honestly just that more and more people are kind of waking up to the dire situation that we're in as a society, as a species. Things need to change. And it's happening well outside of, you know, the realm of people thinking about fungi. But I'm just reminded of like Naomi Klein's mandate that she's been articulating to like have good ideas lying around, because plenty of bad ideas are lying around. And when crisis strikes, whatever's at hand is often what gets implemented. And so the ways of being and relating, the values that I see expressed in these communities, and that I think one finds kind of inevitably through what I call fungal fellowship, you know, or through the path that starts by discovering mushrooms and leads to such a much broader picture. I feel like as that gets more reified and you know, more widespread and hopefully easier to come into contact with, say via a book, that it'll help some of the ideas that I find really compelling and valuable in this space to be lying around when they're needed. I think that's what's giving me the most hope at the moment.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for coming on today. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you both so much. This was a joy.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.